Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. However, we are not broadcasting from Nice Guy Productions World Headquarters, overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, but rather this was recorded live at the Grimfest Film Festival in Manchester, England. And it's a special event. We are here to celebrate John Carpenter's The Thing, and celebrating with me is the great actor-writer from Inside Number 9, Rhys Shearsmith. And we express our love for John Carpenter's The Thing on its 40th anniversary at that festival, and I thought I would love to share this conversation with you. So here we go.
Just to say that this film was chosen by Rhys as his favourite monster movie.
Yeah.
So we were so excited that he chose this film. It's the 40th anniversary 4K remastered version that you're going to see later tonight, so it's very cool. I'm going to hand you over to Mick Garris, who is going to host this talk with Rhys.
Thank you.
Live from the BFI Grimfest Monsters and Movies event in Manchester, England. This is Postmortem, and I'm Mick Garris, and we are here with a crowd to celebrate the 40th anniversary of John Carpenter's The Thing with one of our favorite guests, Rhys Shearsmith, writer and performer on Inside Number 9, League of Gentlemen, and so many other things, and one of my favorite performers, and a great guest, and we're going to talk about monsters in movies, particularly John Carpenter's The Thing. This is being held before we screen the actual movie with an audience, and it was Rhys's pick as his favorite monster movie.
That's right, yes. And my first, can you hear me? Yes. Question is, who hasn't seen it? See, I know people. Get out.
Too bad.
Actually, stay, you've seen it, yes. So, well, the problem now is we are still going to spoil it. We have to. We've got to talk about it first. Yeah, I mean, I don't really have any right to be here pontificating about The Thing when Mick Garris was on the set watching it being filmed. So I'm going to turn the tables and ask you about what that was like. But
yeah, but the whole point is this is a favorite movie of yours.
Yeah,
you are a performer, you're a writer.
Yeah.
In the genre, Inside Number 9 takes a lot of deep walks into the horror field.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, one of the reasons why I picked this film was for me, and I'm sure for a lot of people that have around my age, it was a film that I saw on videotape. Obviously, it was the height of it was 80s, and I saw it, and I remember feeling something I'd never felt before about any horror or anything I'd seen, and I was already a huge horror fan. And it was the fact, it was like a veil had lifted on something I'd never, I knew was possible. The effects in this film and the practical effects blew me away quite seriously. I was like, I cannot believe the things I am seeing. How have they done?
The things you were seeing.
The things I was seeing, yeah. And the incarnations of the things. But more than that as well, I think it was the... and I'm sure Mick will talk about this, but the plotting of the script and the fact that it was a sort of, it's an Agatha Christie, really. It feels like it's a whodunit, but it's who is doing it and who is it, yeah. Who is the thing. And that was one of the great hooks for me as not just waiting on the next enormous, brilliant effect, special effect, but of course that helps when you're a kid watching it. But I remember this was... prime Creepshow, my obsession with Creepshow, and then this came out, and it was just one of those films that has just stayed with me as, and it's never been bettered. And what I can't fathom was how bad the reviews were.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't matter to me as a kid because I just got on videotape, shouldn't have been even watching it at my age, but I watched it, and now I look back and I hear, and I've read them, it had terrible reviews, didn't it?
And it did not do good box office. And at that time, Carpenter, of course, was hugely disappointed. Here had been the year of E.T. So that's the friendly alien that comes to Earth. And it was the biggest movie of all time. And so people were in the mood for Happy Time. Happy Time monsters, rather than something as visceral as what John Carpenter provided. And I remember saying to him, wait 10 or 15 years, I'll bet you anything people will really speak fondly of this. And now, E.T., great movie. Everybody loves it. Nobody except an asshole hates E.T. But with John Carpenter's The Thing, we talk about The Thing all the time. We don't talk so much about E.T.
Yeah, and I wonder whether it was, because it was 1982, wasn't it, this film, and whether it was the... They decided, whoever they are, that we don't want the 70s French Connection where everything's horrible at the end anymore. And it was just sort of repulsed. It was just not the flavour of the month to be, because it's so bleak. I mean, those that haven't seen it, you wait. But
the ending itself is.
Apparently, you told me, Mick, there were three different endings.
Yeah, there were three different endings, written and shot.
Wow.
And John Carpenter did not share them with anybody. And I don't know what the other two endings were, but I guarantee you this is the right end.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just looking. I wrote them down because I wanted to have a look at the script of The Thing. And I was just fascinated to... And I thought, this is why the film is brilliant. This is... The start of the script reads with a breakdown of each character. And these are the character breakdowns. And when you hear this, this is why you realize it's so brilliant, because it's so lean. MacReady, 35, helicopter pilot, likes chess, hates the cold, the pay is good. Gary, 46, station manager, stiff, ex-army officer, wears a handgun. Giles, 33, 6'4", 55, 250, black, a mechanic, can be jolly, but don't mess. Blair, 50, sensitive, intelligent, unassuming, an assistant biologist. Dr. Copper, 45, professional, decent man, a good doctor. Palmer, 27, second string, chopper pilot. Crap mechanic, long hair, slight 60s acid damage. And I'm reading them all because each one, when you know it, and I'm sure you all do, you just go, yes, 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 yes. And how brilliantly they've all encapsulated these descriptions. Knowles, 22, the cook, bright, black, irreverent, but kind-hearted, roller skates. Norris, 44, stocky, rugged-looking, geophysicist, an incipient heart condition. We'll get to that later. An incipient heart condition. Bennings, 38, meteorologist, dutiful, an old pro. Clark, 24, a dog handler, likes it here, good at his job. Sanchez, 21, the radio operator, hates it here, lousy at his job. And I just thought, wow, how brilliant is that as character descriptions? And clearly right up front, they knew exactly what they were doing.
Yeah, it's so beautifully cast, too.
Yeah.
And the script was by Burt Lancaster's son, Bill Lancaster, who had written The Bad News Bears. So here are two sides of the cinema coin that could not be less alike. And the script is brilliant. Did you read the short story before? Which thing did you see first? The Christian Nyby or this one?
Christian Nyby, yeah.
So you saw it on television?
I saw it on television, yeah. Late night, one night, yeah. And it was all, and even that, I mean, in its own way, is terrifying.
It's a classic.
It's a classic,
even,
yeah.
Even James Arness from Gunsmoke as the living carrot.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And it's, you know, it's not this thing, but the creeping claustrophobia is still there. Yeah. And that's, I think, one of the great things about this film and how you completely so quickly care about this set of men and their plight.
And you say men, and that's very specific because particularly at that time, there always had to be a woman in it, a romantic involvement. And it was a ballsy move to do something that was just all testosterone.
Yeah. And do you think that that would have been a question mark over, you've got to have a woman in it?
Yeah, because the original version that Howard Hawks produced, that Christian Nyby directed, did have a woman in it.
Right.
That was, had romantic appeal to the lead actor. But I think one of the strengths is that it just ignores that part of the story. And it was not part of the original short story, Who Goes There? But it's just got a very rugged feel to it, and it's in the middle of the most rugged place on Earth, which they actually shot it on a glacier in British Columbia. And in the summer, we talked about this earlier,
yeah.
But in the summer they built that station and then shot it in the winter, so it was all snowed over and iced over, and they really worked hard to give this veracity.
Yeah, and how long was it that, I mean, was it, what point did you come on board to end up being on that shoot? Were you going to do the making of?
I did the making of. Yeah. I wasn't on it very long, but I was also doing specialized publicity for the genre magazines of the time and things like that. So I went to Alaska and British Columbia and was there on the glacier, the coldest I've ever been in my life. And I was on the sound stages. The scene with "You Gotta Be Fucking Kidding Me," I think all of you know that scene, with the head coming off and all. I was there watching that, and it was an amazing experience to go to see Carpenter watching the rehearsals of it and say, "Rubber." So it didn't look real enough.
Right.
So they relit and got it till it was right. But a lot of that stuff had to be done second unit because it was so complicated. They planned on an additional shoot that went way beyond the first unit shoot.
Wow. I mean, it's amazing to me to think that there's so much of it is in camera, the effects, and how it's a ballsy thing to do. I mean, we've done small little things in the things I've filmed, and they've been in-camera things, and it always looks slightly unconvincing, and there's a leap of faith that people will buy it.
Yeah.
So this must have been quite a big thing to think. It sort of stands and falls on these effects being convincing in a way that they're so not. I mean, it's extraordinary what you see before your eyes in this, and yet you want to buy it as really happening.
And when they remade it, they tried to do the same thing, and they did it all practical effects, and it didn't work. And they went over it with CG,
right,
trying to fix it all, and the movie did not perform well. And it certainly can't stand up next to Carpenter's film, but it was also in the forefront of this technology. And Rob Bottin, who did the makeup effects, he was an assistant to Rick Baker. He was 19 years old, and he worked on The Fog with John Carpenter, and that's how they started their relationship together.
Didn't he play Blake?
Yeah, he actually plays Blake with the red eyes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the ghost of Blake. So John knew that Rob was a creative genius. And here's a kid in his early 20s being tasked with the burden of millions of dollars of special effects that had never been done before. There'd been precedent with Dick Smith and his bladder work on The Exorcist originally and that sort of thing. And then American Werewolf in London, Rick Baker did that. And at the same time, Rob Bottin did The Howling with Joe Dante. And so he ended up having this unbelievable burden of delivering this, and he's brilliant, but that takes time, and nobody planned on the time that it actually took to do all of the creature effects.
I'll bet, yeah. I mean, it seems, I can't imagine the preparation for it.
Yeah,
and waiting on how he must have designed the creatures, because they see, obviously, every single step of the way, it must have been thought about, but when you arrive at each of the new incarnations of the thing and how you get there via the dogs or via someone's head or whatever it might be, that's the work involved and how each one is its own new monster in the movie is an amazing achievement, because it's not nebulous and it's not sort of thrown together. Obviously, it can't be, because he needs to make those puppets.
It used to be that you'd rely on the audience's imagination until the last act, and then you'd give time to your creature. But in this case, once things start going, they are nonstop.
Yeah. And how much of was all the creature creations and the looks of them, Rob Bottin bringing them, this person could change into this spider monster type?
All of it was Rob, and John gave him his head and said, look, this is what I want. How you achieve it, show me some ideas. Tell me what you want to do. And it's way more than anybody ever planned on originally in the movie, just because Rob was so brilliant and his work was so amazing. But none of that would work. No monster movie works if the people aren't any good.
Yeah.
And the characters are so well drawn and so beautifully played by this great cast with, you know, everybody loved Kurt Russell, and nobody had ever seen him in a role like this, MacReady. And, you know, the commitment, again, we talked about that element of a movie, the commitment of the actors to what is being called tonight a monster movie. And normally that's in a gutter, and this was given front row treatment.
Absolutely, yeah. It's elevated by, you know, it's not elevated, it's just really great acting. The same way that the three principals in Jaws make it a brilliant film, and that's why I think you can rewatch them, and because you just find new nuance in all their performances to this day.
I'd love to see. I'm not a big fan of 3D, but did you see the conversion of Jaws to 3D?
No, I didn't.
It's brilliant.
Is it?
It's so good that it makes me want to see the thing with the same conversion, but it looks like Spielberg shot it in 3D. The shots are so three-dimensional, and the movements and the like, that it was captured in 3D in a way I never imagined I would love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
This would be an amazing movie to see converted in that way.
Yeah, definitely. And it's 42 years now, is it? Or is it 41?
40 years for The Thing. It was 1982, summer of
amazing,
1982.
Yeah. No, I remember when I first saw this, inexplicably it was on a videotape, probably pirated from Blockbusters or the like. But on the other end of it, I think The Thing was on it, and then it ended, and there was a crackle of videotape, and then it was The House That Dripped Blood.
Really?
Which is such a strange film to have on the end of it. Nothing like it. Is that a weird...
No,
is that an amicus? That's a portmanteau horror was on the other end of it.
Yeah, that was one of those.
It was very strange, yeah. And I used to treasure it and watch it all the time.
The whole thing was on it?
Yeah, it was all on it, yes. It was all crackly on it used to get very crackly on the bits where the more extreme bits. Yes, of course it was, yeah. But, I mean, like I say, it completely, indelibly is scarred on my brain, because I thought, I genuinely thought, I can't believe I'm seeing these things. Obviously, I'd loved Hammer and those kind of things, but this was something else. It was like I never, I've not seen, what year was American Werewolf?
American Werewolf was 81.
81, so that had happened, yeah, but this was, I think it obviously landed because it was a truthful. There was no nothing gothic about it. It was all very real and technical and like
and
these
contemporary.
People and contemporary. Yeah. So you're left with this terrible feeling that it's all so close to what could really happen.
What was
and
the
even
first...
though we were in such an exotic place as the snow.
Yeah, and it was such veracity to it, because it was a real place in the middle of fucking nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible to me that they built it and then let the snow fall on it, and then that's how they had it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is so authentic for
beautiful
them.
Production design.
Yeah, and you said they've... refrigerated the insides for the breath.
Yeah, on the sound stages on the Universal lot, they built all of the interiors to the station, and John had them all refrigerated so you would actually see breath. There was no CG at the time, and so there was no, and even to this day they haven't perfected CG breath. But he wanted to see that, and you know, that rarely happened in movies that take place in the frozen north, but John's that kind of filmmaker.
Yeah, and I read that the interiors were filmed in the height of the summer, so they were all in their winter outfits going out and being completely sweltering outside.
Yes. And so they were happy to go into the stage.
Yeah, to cool down.
What was the first monster movie you ever saw?
I think maybe like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, or one. Oh, wow. It was probably a Ray Harryhausen of some incarnation. So it will have been Telos or one of those where that, you know, incredibly, when I got to meet Ray and go to his house and see Telos, that's about that big.
Wow.
And I thought, this has been in my life like it could never have not existed in the world. And there it is in a glass case. And it was quite incredible to see that. Yeah.
Well, stop motion monsters. I think maybe The Son of Kong was the first one I saw on television.
Yeah.
And just, I knew it wasn't real because the fur would move with every frame that was taken because of the fingerprints on it and the like.
Yeah.
But there was something about it that just hooked me. It was magical. And I wasn't afraid of it. I embraced it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of genre fans do embrace the monster because we were not the high school cheerleaders and heroes and sportsmen and the like, but really feel more like on the outside looking in. And I think there's an identity with the monster within this genre that is unique to our genre.
Yeah, because the monster is the outcast and the potential loner, you know, that is misunderstood. And that's us a lot in this room.
And there's also the other side of us, the bad side of us, the Jekyll and Hyde monster, where the transitional monster, like the Thing, we could turn into that, or it could subsume us into itself.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, and the Thing is an example of that delicious thing that you get in werewolf films or Jekyll and Hyde, where there is a transformation. And that's always, when the camera doesn't, when you know there's going to be one and something starts to happen and it doesn't cut away, and we're going to get to see from A to B, in all its difficult, agonizing, sweaty glory.
And in the Thing,
delicious.
It's A to Z.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you can't quite believe the twists and, quite literally, the twists and turns of the things that happen to the human body in this film.
Yeah, I'm so excited for this audience, the members of the audience who haven't seen it, because these spoilers are not spoilers.
Yeah, this is actually fine.
There's no way anybody could tell you anything that would ruin this movie for you, unless you have terrible taste. So,
so what was your first, so you think it was Kong then?
Son
first
of
monster,
Kong.
Yeah.
Yeah, and my mother had seen it as a very small child in the original King Kong in a cinema. And was sitting on her father's leg and peed her pants.
Really?
Because it was so scary.
That's quite
so
something.
She wanted to set up a very nutritious setting for us to see Son of Kong. Watched it with both parents, four kids together around the TV set, so it would be comfortable and nice. Well, it turns out Son of Kong is a comedy. And so she took all these precautions for us not to be afraid, and there was nothing to be afraid of.
Right, yeah, of course. When I had my, and I've talked about it a lot, and you've obviously had dinner with him, but my meal with Christopher Lee, I asked him, or John Landis asked him, what was his scariest monster, and he said Karloff as the creature.
Wow.
He said he has it burned in his memory, that first reveal of when the creature, when he turns, he sort of stumbles backward, doesn't he?
And then he turns to face the camera.
That slow build, moves in on him, dum, 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 doesn't it? And there's a slight blurring in the middle one. It's actually very disarming that he suddenly snaps into focus. Yeah.
Well, the 1931 Frankenstein is so groundbreaking because it's really cinematic. You look at the Dracula from the same year, and
play. Clunky.
It's very static. And James Whale had this way, he understood the tools of cinema in a way that few other filmmakers of that day, other than maybe the impressionist German filmmakers, had with Caligari and things like that. But the Universal Group seemed to bring in those ideas and a lot of those technicians from Germany, and they contributed a lot to the look of that. But that was the one that really kind of became the face of quality horror.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it, how we've never really moved away from, and you can't help yourself but love them, because it's sort of, there's just something obviously in us that want to see things, monsters versus monsters, and we have it to this day with the Marvel creations meeting each other, and
right even from King Kong and Godzilla.
Absolutely,
are back.
Yes, of course, yeah, and you get these teams of monsters and people, Predator v Alien.
Yeah.
And there was a famous, I read about it recently, another Carpenter thing, that they were going to, I think there was talk of having Michael Myers versus, and who was it?
Was it Jason?
I think it was Jason. Yeah, it was like that. What world do they meet?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. They'd figure it out because
I mean, they did do Jason and Freddy, didn't they?
Yeah,
and I think it did quite well.
It did. But you know, as far as franchise horror goes, I'm just tired of it. You know, there's so much smart filmmaking out there, people who really know how to tell original stories. And it's actually a good time for horror movies right now, because you get things that, in addition to all the praise and the new Hellraiser, the new Scream, all that, but you've got Black Phone, you've got The Menu, you've got Smile, you've got Bodies, 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 and these are all original theatrical releases that weren't birthed from previous generations of the same movie.
Yeah, exactly. And it's slightly depressing, isn't it, when you sort of see a big studio film where you know the type of film you're going to get instantly just by their iconography at the beginning. You think, oh, it's going to be one of those films, and it plays itself out, and it's like you've already seen it, and it's almost like that's the raison d'etre, that you're expected to like it because you know exactly what you're going to get.
Yes, familiarity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it breeds contempt.
Quite literally, yeah. But yes, I mean, especially in a world where, you know, with my little program that we try to every time do the opposite of that, which is try to do something that you're not expecting and hopefully not repeat yourself. But it seems to be that they are there to do exactly that, to repeat themselves.
At a certain point, the returns diminish. And you see that happening even with Marvel movies. They still make billions of dollars, but they seem to be making less than their predecessors recently. And maybe that's a healthy thing. I mean, any movie that gets people to go to the cinema and buy a ticket and see it in the seats just encourages more movies to be made and a wider variety of movies.
Yeah. And do you think... They did, like you say, that's fascinating to me that you said that they did the impractical effects on the remake when they did the Norwegian camp.
Yes.
But then they overlaid it with CG because they didn't work. But why didn't the practical effects work?
I don't know. You know, they're very talented guys who did that. But it's all how it's shot. It's all how it plays. And with a modern audience, you have to be even more convincing. You know, we'll look at the thing from 1982 from a modern perspective. If you're 22 years old and haven't seen it before, it may look like foam latex and Vaseline and alginate and snot and all that.
Yeah.
But in 1982, when we went there, there had been no precedent. It was brand new. So maybe it did not convince a test audience, and they figured, well, we can fix that in post.
But the thing that I think was the thing that was lacking
was... We're going to have that.
You can't help it. I think is the strong characters across the board because, again, we go back to the fact that it is a sort of... and then there were none. Murder mystery, really. And part of it is the thrill of thinking who is patient zero.
Right.
Who first gets infected and that... horror of it being you next.
Yeah, and when you find out who it is, that's only the middle of the movie.
Yeah,
and
absolutely,
then it
takes
it from there.
Yeah, it escalates, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, the monster parties kind of began in the 40s with Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, Son of Dracula, and all the trailers would go, see Frankenstein, the Hunchback, and Dracula, and
all
Wolfman,
in one place.
All in one big place. Did you watch those as a kid?
I remember seeing that and then sort of being thrilled that you're going to get two or three bites of the cherry. I'm always with Abbott and Costello, they would often be on, but I never really got them very... I didn't.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They weren't big here, I don't think.
That was a huge movie to me. I've seen it and Hard Day's Night more than any other movie.
Really?
And just a month ago, not even a month ago, celebrating Halloween, I hosted a screening of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein at the Cinematheque in Los Angeles.
Wow.
And it was a 35-millimeter print. It was beautiful, and the crowd ranged in age from like 5 years old all the way up to people with gray hair like mine. And it worked gangbusters. But it may be an American thing. We're in England right now. I don't know how many Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein fans are in here. Show yourself.
There you go.
There's eight. So yeah, it's a big cultural thing.
Yeah, I would have loved it if, because I loved Laurel and Hardy, and they would be here. They would be on.
They had more heart.
All the time, but they were at heart, yeah. But imagine them meeting the Wolfman. They would have probably knocked him out with a ladder or something like that.
Buster Keaton meets the Wolf.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So who were the British horror heroes for you?
Oh, well, I mean, I grew up with Hammer House of Horror, which was the TV spin-off of the Hammer films. I thought it was, but of course what happened was it wasn't at all, in its own creepy way, that the TV versions of the under that banner were very sort of grubby and real, because they were all on council estates in Great Missenden and quite and not gothic in the slightest. They were, that was a surprise to me that when that came on TV.
But there were mysteries too.
And there was Hammer House of Mystery and Suspense, yeah, which was not as good, I don't think. I think started out life as a second season of Hammer House of Horror and didn't quite end up being quite the same thing. So they call them Hammer House of Mystery and Suspense. But for me, the Hammer House of Horrors, I remember them coming on TV. I remember the night, the Witching Hour, that was the first one came on. And then the Denham Elliot one as well, which was just a sort of brilliant, horrible, sickly story of this man that keeps thinking his dream. He keeps waking up and his dreams start repeating, until the point where he kills his wife and he thinks it's a dream. I'll wake up in a minute, and it was real. And he's killed his wife, and he thinks he gets arrested for it. And he's like, "No, I'm going to wake up in a minute," but he doesn't. So that was probably all that BBC Two late night. We used to have a double bill of a black and white, a Universal, and then there would be a 1:05 in the morning, impossibly late for a 12-year-old boy in the morning to watch the second one, which would be a Hammer or an Amicus, even worse, an Amicus film.
Oh, even better.
Yeah, because they were even more bloody. And, yeah. But my sort of memories of monster films, particularly in that genre of my life era, was being terrified of Curse of the Werewolf. Is that's the Oliver Reed?
Oh, the Oliver Reed one, yeah.
The Oliver Reed one kept me awake, because I remember watching the Oliver Reed one at about 2 o'clock in the morning by myself, going to bed, and then being kept awake, absolutely convinced that there was a Oliver Reed in a white shirt was prowling the streets of Hull.
Well, what's amazing about that?
And it was foxes. Making that horrible noise that foxes
Werefoxes.
Do. Werefox, yeah.
Well, the amazing thing about that is the makeup is one of the most realistic of all the werewolf makeups. It doesn't try to turn him into a dog face so much. You know, the Lon Chaney one with the lap dissolves doing the transformation like. This used his face a lot. And it looked very human but animalistic at the same time. And it was kind of revolutionary in the way they presented a werewolf, because we're so used to seeing it in a big, bulky suit.
Yeah, and it sort of didn't just do... It took the legend of the idea of that and did something else with it, because you saw him... There was this time spent in the film of when he was a boy werewolf.
Yeah.
And that as well. So, and it just sort of extrapolated the story into something that you'd never really, you know, it was sort of the origin story in its first incarnation, because you never really got that much detail. We always arrived at the werewolf when he was prowling and killing people. But this was this is when he was a boy as well. And that was interesting to me.
Yeah, fascinating. And it took the Brits to do that.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I mean, Hammer always was cozy to me. Twins of Evil was a great one I used to watch as well.
Yeah. And very sexy.
Yes. And those films now, and Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, I remember particularly.
Martine Beswick.
Yes, enjoying that, Ralph Bates. And then there are, of course, all the incarnations that Christopher Lee did of Dracula. And I've recently really reevaluated I thought it was rubbish, but it's actually really good, and good in a sort of sickly way. Satanic Rites, which is the last Dracula he did.
Yeah.
And it's really good. I think it's... and with Peter Cushing as well. So it's got a real... it's after... AD 73, which was
right.
sort of its own mad thing.
It was very mod.
It was, yeah. But this one is even sort of more modern, and it's about spreading the plague,
yeah.
essentially, via Dracula. And it's something really good about it.
Well, you were talking about meeting Christopher Lee, and I met with him as well through John Landis
yeah.
in the same way. But Christopher Lee was on my old Z Channel interview show back in the, like, 1979 or something. And we showed The Wicker Man. And he really didn't want to talk about Dracula. And it kind of was heartbreaking that he resented that people thought of him as Dracula when Dracula gave him the opportunity to play this wide panoply of roles that he enjoyed, including The Wicker Man, which was one of his two favorite performances.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, by his latter years, he was sort of claiming he'd never done a horror film. I've never done a terror film.
Yeah,
that's what he said, a terror film.
The Cinema Wicker Fantastic. Man is the most important film in history.
Is that what he said?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or something to that effect.
Yes.
Yeah. What was the first monster movie you saw in the theater? Do you remember?
Oh, that's a good... the first monsters of that frightened me actually was Peter Cushing, it was Doctor Who and the Daleks.
Oh, wow.
So I went to see that. I remember I had the choice when I was little. My mum said, we're going to go to the... It was the summer of 1976 or something. When was Grease out? 76?
Yeah.
You can either see Grease or Doctor Who and the Daleks.
Oh, that's an easy one.
And I said, well, Doctor Who and the Daleks. So that, and I remember being quite frightened by the idea of the Dalek. The thing that was added that I don't think was in the TV, in the films of the Daleks, was this horrible alien-like creature in... at the center of the machine themselves. Mm. So the head would come off and then you'd see this blob thing that was like a octopus in the middle of the Dalek's head.
Wow.
I think I don't watch Doctor Who now, but I think they maybe still do that.
Maybe.
But it was sort of this idea that it was organic within the metal structure.
Yeah, that's very biomechanical.
Yes,
alien.
It was, yeah. It was like some like Terminator type thing. But yeah, that would be my earliest cinematic experience of it. I remember... And it was sort of, it springboarded my interest in special effects and makeup, but seeing in cinema The Company of Wolves.
Oh, brilliant.
Which was a great...
Jordan movie.
Yeah, Neil Jordan, and that whole sort of fantasy, fairy tale world with Christopher Tucker, who did the makeup. And, of course, I ended up writing to Chris Tucker, who did... He'd done the makeup for The Elephant Man. And at the time, he'd just finished Company of Wolves. And I was obsessed with trying to get into that world. And I wrote to him. We had a sort of pen pal correspondence where I would send him my animatronical arms and I'd take pictures of it and he would give me advice. And it was an amazing sort of association with him, because I thought, if I ever get to do this, I'm completely in here with the right person to maybe actually do this for real with. Then I went to Bretton Hall and studied acted, as if you can do such a thing.
ODR.
And then after Bretton Hall for 3 years and deciding I wanted to be an actor, he wrote to me and said, do you want to come and work for me? And I couldn't believe it. And I said, yes. And I'd already thought I'd left that part of me behind. But I went to work in his house in Pangbourne, in Berkshire, where I was sort of like Jonathan Harker in Dracula. I arrived and I didn't know what the setup was. It was so strange. There were other people there, like drones, working for him, white-faced young men and women that had obviously also been asked to go and work there, and were just slush molding makeup for the theatrical production of The Phantom of the Opera, which he'd done the makeup for. And I was joined on the production line of doing that. And I was just sort of looking around saying, how long have you been here? Can't remember. And I was like, what happens? Are we paid? What? No, you're not paid. And food would be like slid under the door at night.
A sandwich.
Yeah. And I was in a room and I had Gregory Peck's head from The Boys from Brazil with a neck ripped out, which he also did. And the Elephant Man's head was there. And I just thought, this is insane. What am I? And I sort of stuck it out for about a month. And then in the end, I literally phoned a taxi in the middle of the night and went home. And got out.
Rather than sleep on the floor backstage.
Yes, exactly. I don't know what... Someone tell me what the situation is. How am I just here now? I began to not remember my life before it.
So that was my... I think you made the
right choice. Yeah, well, yeah.
Right?
I don't know what would have happened. So I left it, yes, and that was my foray into makeup and special effects, but always a great love of it. And I would, you know, and when we're filming and I'm having my head cast,
yeah,
it's my favourite part because I get to sort of be in that world again.
So you're not claustrophobic?
No, yes, it can be quite scary. I remember doing sort of prototype face casts with my dad, who was a builder, and had because of course you do it properly, you have alginate first and then you plaster beyond it to get a nice stiff backing so you can then mould your face. But we did it with like the most rough grouting that you could get on my face. But I've got one from when I was about 13, my head, my face, and it's very sad to look at it now. I think, look at that beautiful face. And what it's become. But yeah, it was nice to have that as a memory because I remember it being a very exciting day when I asked my dentist, well, I asked my mum, will you ask the dentist if we can get a bag of the alginate?
Yes.
Because the teeth, it was the only thing I could weigh into getting to buy a big £3 bag of alginate.
Right.
So I did it, and then I cast my face properly and a second time. But yeah, you do it, and you have your mouth covered, and you have
and
to
it's
be,
like 15 to 20
you've
minutes.
You've got to be calm, yeah, and you breathe through your nose. It's terrifying, actually.
And I am claustrophobic.
Some people can't do it, can they?
I'm one of them. I did it once. I had my face cast when I was one of the zombies in Michael Jackson's Thriller.
Right.
And so...
As you do.
As one would, right? But that experience... It was worth it, but I don't think I could do it again.
Right.
But going through that process of being made up for 3 hours, and then it's an hour to take it off, and you do it often on your show.
Yeah, I mean, we used to do it more with League of Gentlemen, it was always quite subtle, but it does take time, and you've got to sort of lean into it rather than resist it, because there is a serenity that comes with just sitting, allowing your face to be... At 5:30 in the morning, people to get to work on it, and it's. I think we're good at it. People often say to us, the makeup people, "You haven't moved. You're very still." And I think I think you do get actors that are just pulling it off continually leaving it, and tashes are hanging off. And I'm sort of aware because I've got my makeup and special effects head on. What it's like to have to reset, and I do just sit very still in between takes, and I. Otherwise, you get fiddled with continually. You know, there's that constant thing of in filming where it can become irritating. You just want to get away from me. I remember speaking to Kathy Burke. I did something with her, and she said, "You know why I stopped it?" And I said, "No, because of all the fucking fiddling." And that was one of the reasons she gave it up. She couldn't bear it. All that touching and constant, like, tweaking. I did a sitcom when I played a doctor, and all my abiding memory of it all the time was I had a stethoscope around my neck, and every single take, between takes, the continuity people would come and move the stethoscope.
Yeah, fiddle.
And I said, "You've moved it! I never moved it! It hasn't moved from the last time. You've now moved it. You've changed it." So that would really annoy me. But, it was like, that's one of the terrible pressures of my life. You have people coming up touching you all the time.
Well, one of the great
and my brother is a trawler fisherman.
one of the great things about monsters are transitional monsters, the ones that start out as one thing and become something else, particularly humans. And the tools have evolved so much. You know, practical effects are great, but digital effects, if used properly, can really make things even more realistic. When they're used on their own, it's more difficult to give them weight. But when you start with a makeup effect and then you process it, the morphing in Sleepwalkers 30 years ago was something we couldn't have done the way that American Werewolf did it, just because of the time. And the effect was instant. We wanted to see something change very quickly. And CGI was brand new at the time. And using those tools together just kind of opened up an entirely new world of makeup effects.
Yeah, I think think that's exactly right. It's the gulf between, it's using it carefully, isn't it, and knowing when it augments it and help adds to it rather than takes away.
Yeah. Because it can look very cartoony. They're getting better and better every day.
So. Yeah.
And you'll see every movie you see these days has digital technology in it, and you just don't notice if it's done really well.
Yeah, and other times it's stuff where you think, that's clear, that's really bad.
Yeah.
And it's in, and am I meant to think it's bad? It's drawn my attention to it.
Yes.
And you're not sure whether it's almost like, is it deliberate? Are you just expecting that will go over my head because that's what everything is like? But sometimes it does really ping out as like a moment you think they could fix or should have fixed.
And even when practical effects, you know it's not real because it's a monster movie.
Yeah.
It's still, actors are acting against it. It has weight. You can touch each other. You can rend each other's blood.
Yeah.
But the marriage of technologies can really, has expanded the ability to create monsters in ways that had never been done before.
Absolutely, yeah. And the other thing we should say about the thing is the music.
Oh, yeah.
Is one of the most powerful and sort of queasy, disturbing, depressing pieces of music, I think. There's something really haunting about it. It really literally creeps into you.
Yeah, and it's credited to Ennio Morricone, but it just sounds like John Carpenter.
Yes, yeah.
It really sounds like him.
Yeah.
You know, there's no electric guitar, for one thing.
Yeah. Was it scored by someone?
And then Ennio Morricone?
It was him. And that is him then.
It is him, but there's obviously a tremendous influence by the director.
Of course, yeah, there has to be with it being.
And he really changed the course of soundtracks in horror films with Halloween. Suddenly you had the Jawa films with the music of Goblin that was very reminiscent of what had been done with John. And that's when I met John, I interviewed him for a magazine and in this tiny little recording studio in Hollywood, and he was recording the score to Halloween.
No.
Yeah.
He said, Mick said earlier, he's the Zelig of horror films, and he is. He's literally been at every significant point in the entire history of horror.
We'll talk about Poltergeist another time.
My God. Are we going to ask questions, or are we not going to do that?
We have to wrap it up.
We've got to wrap it up.
3 minutes. So,
right, okay.
But I love that we're able to be here as fans.
Absolutely,
and talk about a movie that we're passionate about that I don't know anybody who doesn't like John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah.
And if I did, I wouldn't like them.
Correct. Yeah, no, I mean, it's amazing that we're finally meeting face-to-face. I thought it might happen, but never as quickly as it has.
Yeah, I'm so happy about this. And Reese, thank you so much for sharing more time with us and being one of our few return guests.
Oh, well, you're
And
I'm
to do it
welcome.
In a really special show and with an audience here. So thanks, everybody here, for joining us for Postmortem.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.